Hello, everybody, and thanks for your patience, and thanks, Ray, for joining us from the other side of the ocean and quite a bit of that other continent as well. Introducing you to Raymond Antrobus, who is our resident poet this term. We've been very lucky to have him with us, and we have him with us for 2 more days. As many of you already know, he was born in London, of a British mother and a Jamaican father. He's an author of Shapes and Disfigurements, To Sweet and Bitter, Perseverance. I think I pronounce it differently than you do, Perseverance, okay. And All the Names Given. He's a winner of the Ted Hughes Award. He was the Guardian Book of the Year in 2018. And, most important for us, he's the 2019 winner of the Sunday Times Young Writer Award, which the University of Warwick is part of. And so our prize is to welcome him to our electronic home. In addition to all of these distinctions, he could just sit at home and write poetry, but he so doesn't. He's a founding member of Chillpill, founding member of Keats House Poets Forum. He's an ambassador for the Poetry School, and that's just the beginning. There are a lot of other things you want to ask him about. He also writes for young readers. Ken Bear's Sea. When did that come up, Ray?
That came out a couple of weeks ago in the US, and
Yeah.
it'll be out in England in February.
Excellent, excellent. I can't wait. And also, is you're on the GCSE syllabus now. Yeah, is what is how does that feel?
It's surreal. It is surreal. I can't lie. Also, like, not even like one of my favorite poets is growing up was Adrian Mitchell, and I remember Adrian Mitchell having a stance like they wanted to put one of his poems on the GCSE syllabus, and he was like, "No, don't. If you put my poems on the GCSE syllabus, it'll kill my poetry. No one will want to read me after they leave school." I do think about that as well, but
Yeah. Anyway, I think it's good. I think it's good. Anyway, so what I'm going to hand over to you to do your thing, and then at a certain point, I'll ask you questions. The rest of you can ask questions. Yes? Okay. So go for it. Go for it.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here with me. Oh, sorry, it's afternoon where you are. Wow. It's around 7:45 in here. Hope you're doing well. Thank you for joining me today. What I'm going to do is I thought that I would keep this fairly formal in that I will maybe read some poems, and then maybe we can have like a discussion or something, and then I will base the next poems I read on our discussion. So I think I'm going to read some poems from the Perseverance first. And the just to say, if you haven't read Perseverance, if you're not familiar with it, it's the Perseverance is the name of the pub that my dad used to drink in. So that's one kind of context to it. But the Perseverance as a book is pretty much about family and connection and language spoken and signed. I went to a deaf school as a kid, and so started learning sign from around 11 years old, because it was discovered that I was deaf when I was around 6, 7 years old. And so when I lost my dad passed away about 5 years ago, and I started writing The Perseverance. And the first poem I wrote from the book is the first poem that it begins with while I was in Barcelona. And in Barcelona, you may have gone to Gaudi's cathedral, and Gaudi, the way in which he designed his buildings, he had an idea about sound and how the people experiencing sound inside his buildings would be brought closer to angels because they would experience sound the way that angels do. And so when I'm in Gaudi's buildings, I think about that in a sense of how do deaf people get access to this divinity, this idea of divine sound? You know, are we divine? And that links us to hundreds and hundreds of years of this idea of people who are disabled are less human, and the whole Enlightenment era kind of the question of what makes us human. The conclusion of that was language makes us human. So if you have any kind of language that isn't recognized by whoever is saying this is what language is, then you're immediately dehumanized. Anyway, one other thing I should say is that I'm the grandson of preachers, and so that kind of comes into the book as well. So here's how the perseverance begins, with a poem called Echo. My ear ants whistle as if singing to echo, goddess of noise, the raveled knot of tongues, of blaring birds, consonant crumbs, of dull doorbells, sounds swamped in my misty hearing aid tubes. Gaudi believed in holy sound and built a cathedral to contain it, pulling hearing men from their knees as though deafness was a kind of atheism. Who would turn down God? Even though I have not heard the golden decibel of angels, I have been living in a noiseless palace where the doorbell is pulsated light, and I am able to answer. What? A word that keeps looking in mirrors in love with its own volume. What? I am a one-word question, a one-man patience test. What language would we speak without ears? What is paradise, a world where I hear everything? What? How will my brain know what to hold if it has too many arms? The day I clear out my dead father's flat, I throw away boxes of molding LPs, Garvey, Malcolm X, Mandela, speeches on vinyl. I find a TDK cassette tape on the shelf, the smudged green label reads Raymond speaking. I play the tape in his vintage cassette player and hear my two-year-old voice chanting my name, Antrop, and dad's laughter crackling in the background, not knowing I couldn't hear the word bus and wouldn't until I got my hearing aids. Now I sit here, listening to the space of deafness. Antrop, 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 4. And if you don't catch nothing, there's something wrong with your ears. They've been tuned to the wrong frequency, Kai Miller. So maybe I belong to the universe underwater, where all songs are smeared waves for Salacia, goddess of salt water, healer of infected ears, which is what the doctor thought I had, since deafness did not run in the family, but came from nowhere. So they syringed olive oil and salt water, and we all waited to see what would come out. And no one knew what I was missing, until a doctor gave me a handful of Lego and said to put a brick on the table every time I heard a sound. After the test, I still held enough bricks in my hand to build a house and call it my sanctuary, call it the reason I sat in saintly silence during my grandfather's sermons where he preached the good news I only heard as Babylon's babbling echo. So that's where the book begins. And I think I'll go to the center of the book with the poem, The Perseverance. And so, so the perseverance, as I said, is the pub, and it's my dad. Like when I was growing up, he was a alcoholic. He struggled with that, and so I had quite a few memories thinking back of kind of being left outside the perseverance pub, and not quite knowing, you know, when you have a parent who has any kind of addiction, you don't know what version of them is going to appear. You know, the highly anxious one, the sober one, the intoxicated one. So witnessing that as a child, it gives you anxiety as well. So this poem is there. My dad, outside the pub, my dad was his favorite musician was one of the Wailers, a man called Peter Tosh. And I've taken one of the lines from a Peter Tosh song to begin the poem. The line is, "Love is the man overstanding." Overstanding is a Jamaican phrase, a way of emphasizing how much you understand. I don't understand how overstep. So the perseverance. "I wait outside the perseverance. Just popping in here a minute, I'd heard him say many times before, like all kids with a drinking father, watch him disappear into smoke and laughter. There is no such thing as too much laughter, my father says, drinking in the perseverance until everything disappears. I'm outside counting minutes, waiting for the man, my father, to finish his shot and take me home before it gets dark. We've been here before. No such thing as too much laughter unless you're my mother without my father, working weekends while the perseverance spits him out for a minute. He gives me 50p to make me disappear. 50p in my hand, I disappear like a coin in a parking meter before the time runs out. How many minutes will I lose listening to the laughter spilling from the perseverance while strangers ask, where is your father? I stare at the doors and say, my father is working. Strangers who don't disappear, but hug me for my perseverance. Dad said, this will be the last time before, while the TV spilled canned laughter, us on the sofa in his council flat, knowing any minute the yams will boil, any minute I will eat again with my father, who cooks and serves laughter, good as any Jamaican who disappeared from the island I tasted before overstanding our heat and perseverance. I still hear popping in for a minute, see him disappear. We lose our fathers before we know it, and I am still outside the perseverance, listening with a laughter." Cool. I think another poem to read, which is a kind of important element to this book, is so I won this thing called the Ted Hughes Award, and when I was told I'd won it, I thought I was being set up for something, because in the book, Ted Hughes has a poem called Death School. It was a poem in which he was commissioned to write in the late 70s by the National Theatre in London. And the premise Ted Hughes was given was, go and figure out how people live without language. And so Ted Hughes decides to visit deaf schools in London and just observe them and just write about the children, the deaf young children that he meets. And so he ends up writing this poem called Deaf School, in which he describes deaf young people as unaware, simple pools, lacking a dimension, removed from the vibration of air, alert and simple, lacking a subtle waving aura of sound and responses to sound. So there's all of this kind of ableist what we talk about autism, which is discrimination against deaf people. Like Ted Hughes embodies all of this horrible kind of language, basically directed at deaf young people. So I put it in the book, but I completely erased the poem. So like that, and to Ted Hughes' estate, didn't want me to show any of the poems, so I just had to have it completely erased. And then what I do is I actually do go into deaf schools, including the deaf school I went to in Highgate, and I've told students this story and I've showed them this poem. And I had one student who said, oh, if you turn the book this way, then it starts to look like sound channels rather than just black or redacted erasures. And how many students said that looked like the screen on their audiologist's screen when they're getting their cochlear implants put in. And yeah, I love that. That for me was just an example of, you know, if we are creative with the things that harm us, we get to create a whole new language, a whole new way to to communicate and meet people through the world. And so the poem that I wrote, taking the Ted Hughes language and kind of reappropriating it. Ted Hughes is known for his poem, The Crow, the book-length sequence in which different things get personified, but particularly this crow. So Ted Hughes is always kind of known for his extended metaphors. So I decided to use an extended metaphor to speak back to Ted Hughes. The metaphor I used was the Mississippi River. I happened to be in New Orleans at the time when I came across this poem. And I was living in a house by the Mississippi River, which has its own energy to it. So I went out and sat by the river and I wrote this using Ted Hughes' language as the Mississippi River, speaking back to him. And one of the things about the Mississippi River is so many people that live by it will have a story about something or someone emerging from it. So many people had these stories like, oh, I was in the river and suddenly this thing emerged from it. And that I also kind of took that, and that also ends up in the poem. After reading Death School by the Mississippi River. No one wise calls the river unaware or simple pools. No one wise says it lacks a dimension. No one wise says its body is removed from the vibration of air. The river is a quiet breath taker, gargling mud. Ted is alert and simple. Ted lacked a subtle waving aura of sound and responses to sound. Ted lived through his eyes, but I the colossal currents from the bridge, I riverboats ghosting a geography of fog. Mississippi means big river, named by French colonizers, the natives laughed at their arrogant maps, conquering wind and marking mist. The mouth of the river laughs. A man in a wetsuit emerges, pulls misty goggles over his head. Couldn't see a thing, he breathes heavily. My face was in darkness. No one heard him. The river drowned him out. Cool. So there's three elements to what became the Perseverance. I don't mind opening it up to talk to anyone if anyone wants to talk, or I can just carry on reading. I don't mind.
Just carry on for a while. These are great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. So what I would like to do, I've actually written the next book, which is coming out in September next year. And one of the tricky things, one of the privileges I've had in writing The Perseverance is that I wrote this book almost entirely in the air. I was doing a lot of readings and performances as I was writing the book. And that kind of became an important sounding board for the process for me to write it. Some of the poems I took out of the book, which I just didn't feel were working. And it was the live readings that informed me of what was working and what wasn't. And with COVID and even this situation, I've lost that. So I don't really know. I can't see you. I can't feel you. I have no idea. You might be bored. I don't know what's going on. Writing this whole book now, this new book, without this sounding board, it's made me a little, obviously it's quite nerve-wracking, but I'm going to read some of it and we'll see how we go from there. Let's see. I will read. In the next book, I got married as well. So I've been writing these kind of marriage poems and thinking about the institution of marriage and all of these ideas of marriage that are harmful to people and beautiful to people, depending on how you look at it. And Tabitha is the name of my wife, and she is an art conservator. And so when we go to art exhibitions or galleries, she always has a great, interesting perspective. For example, she's able to look at like a painting and just tell me what colors of a painting will erode first, where the materials for this color was found is I love that. And so I wrote this poem kind of inspired by me and her going to an art gallery in New Orleans and for coming across this painting called Plantation Burial. And the painter happened to be called John Antrobus. And it was such a shift for me to kind of find my name in this little art gallery, because I don't often come across Antrobuses. So I wrote this poem about coming across that and Tabitha's take on it. So it's called Plantation Paint. Tabitha, the art conservator, squints at the color, tells me the paint depicting the black of these men huddled for a burial would decay before the cypress trees surrounding them. There are several kinds of black, she says, and the details question my way of seeing. I worry what kind of black would mark me. I am not the paint made from vine twigs or burnt shells. I am not the lamp full of oil. Tabitha, how you'd paint me. Tell me if I'm closer to the white painter with my name than I am to the black preacher, his hands to the sky, the mahogany rot of heaven. Sorry, but you know by now that I can't mention trees without every shade of my family appearing and disappearing. And if you want to see that painting, you can. It's called Plantation Burial. It's a very atmospheric painting about, basically a burial is happening, and enslaved people are burying someone. And on the periphery, you can see the plantation owners. It's such a stark kind of painting to come across. And then the day after that, if you've been to New Orleans, you know that it's about like food. I eat so well, even though the food isn't the most healthy, I eat a lot of it. So food got me thinking about comfort and love and my mother and being away from home. So I wrote this poem called Not Every Sail Has to Come with Such Heavy Receipts. Are we about to enter history or cafe toot de suite on Verrett Street? The waitress has a face as much African as Vietnamese, as if even the grease on her long white shirt came from a long line of proud Creole cooks. I've always felt guilty needing any small service. My mother is a market trader. As a child, I once kicked a woman who kept talking without buying. I'm thinking my mother could do everything right and still not survive. I've not grown out of carrying anxious bags into every room where I become a customer. It's a thing. If I'm passing a market and the street hagglers want me to name a price, it's hard to say what that should be when I see my mother in tired light saying, this was a good day, this was a bad day. The waitress has a bandana tied tight around her head, apron around her waist, all her kitchen sweats look listened to. Sometimes I feel guilty asking someone to repeat, but she repeats and nobody dies. Maybe kindness is how you take down the stools. This waitress and my mother would show up at my funeral, a short speech written on receipts, but stand next to my coffin, say, we made this hungry man's dish, slow cooked his fish, and he ate messy and grateful as he lived.
Wow. Wow. I just had to say
I'm just scrolling through the book. Wow, I'm looking at all these poems. I'm like, I've never read them. All right, I'll read this poem because it's a poem which I initially wrote a year ago, and I abandoned. And I came back to it and finished it purely because of being in Oklahoma. I'm living in Oklahoma at the moment, and I think one of the biggest surprises I've had about Oklahoma, which I'm embarrassed to say, is the presence of the indigenous people, of natives. because they're still here. Even though there aren't reservations, there's such a huge presence. There's flags and there's different tribes, who are the people who own the land, who are on the land, and their land was stolen from them, of course. I met a man recently who told me this story about a man called John T. Williams, who was an Indigenous man who lost his life to police violence. And because I'd already known about this story as well, because the significance was he was deaf. And so I created these kind of form poems. I called them caption poems, in which there were two poems within one poem. So you've got the caption on one side of the page, and so the caption of the sound that's happening, and on the other side of the page you have a narration, the story. If I could share the screen, I can show you, but no worries. I'll just say the caption, and then I'll read the poem. And so this is also in the book. There's a lot of dream poems as well. So this is called Caption and a Dream for John T. Williams of a Nuhu Cha Nuth Tribe. Sound of unstable air. He fell facing forward from the police officer. Four bullet holes on the left side of his body, hands holding a block of cedar wood and a 3-inch blade he used to carve canoes and faces into totem poles. Announcing it is not over, the police officer said, I yelled at him to drop the knife. Sound of something left out. It took 5 seconds to shoot. John T. Williams' brother sat on the pavement. He didn't turn away from the block of cedar wood that still shone on the road. Careful speech. The reporters pushed microphones into his face. My brother was deaf. Sound of no season. He spoke each word with a trembling broadcast as if his brother could still read his lips. Sound stolen. They took something beautiful from us. Wailing. I dream of the crosswalk at Borden Avenue and Howell Street. In my dream, John T. Williams appears in a whaling canoe. When he paddles, the water doesn't ripple. I ask if he has a favorite sound. The lake melts, becomes a narrow street. A kettle boils silently on the pavement. John T. Williams points at a house. There are still keys hanging in the green door. I follow him into the living room. He is setting the table for a meal. I ask nothing. He pours tea. There is tapping at the window. Someone is humming in the garden by a totem pole, summoning the sound of hands leaving a mark. And in that same, I guess, let me try this. Oh, yeah, I mean, again, there's a couple of poems here which I like on the page. I have no idea if they're going to work out. So I'm gonna try and put this one in the air, because so many of the poems in this book are about my mum, but also about, like, I guess this poem in particular is me trying to be aware of, I guess, ego and need and all this kind of frazzling out, and I needed to write something light about it. So this poem is called I Ran Away From Home to See How Long It Would Take My Mother to Notice. Are you my drunk teacher who took our game of rounders way too seriously? Are you the boy who said I had the ugliest smile on the playground? Are you the girl who toe-punted my balls and made me a piss sack of blood? The girlfriend who slept with women behind my back said it wasn't cheating. I don't know what I'm saying. Will you be my friend? I spent hours in the house alone as a child. I left fingerprints on my sister's CDs so the music kept skipping. I wanted her friends to be my friends, but I wasn't invited to her parties. Are you the party? Are you my dad lying on the sofa saying I'll soon be dead? When I pull What Is Existentialism off my mother's shelf, Simone de Beauvoir says, the movement of my transcendence appears futile. I didn't know what that means, so I put it back. Fuck, who loves me? I'm testing everyone.
I need space for all my old and new gooey needs and projections. I need constant blaring validation alarms. Give me award ceremonies. Please observe my wall of fame. Best second guessing overachiever. Best internal monologue while drying dishes. Best self-promoter at the charity fundraiser. Best awkward silence in a moving vehicle. Best bad advice to a couple in crisis. Best non-smoker in the smoking area. Most self-centered fear during the global pandemic. Lifetime Achievement Award for most convincing head nod in a crowded pub. Most triggered person in an empty house.
You win.
I have no idea.
You win. That was wonderful. I mean, it's very exciting to be your first audience as well. And everybody, as you can see, if you see the prints, I want them to tell you themselves. Okay. So go ahead, Carlotta. You start. Yeah. Can everybody join Chantal? Yeah, Carlotta, are you there? Yes. Anyway. While you're getting there, you're not sure where to start. Okay, if Chantal can do the instructions. I have so many questions, but I want to begin. I mean, these new poems, so much come out of your being on the other side. Yes. In a new part of life. Writing from that distance, but with such force and overstanding. Overstanding, am I using that right? Okay.
Yeah,
I'm taking that. So what is the, you know, how do you understand the transformation that is probably still going on? You know, because new poems are, they're again different. They're different.
Oh yeah. Oh, this is like a different. Yeah. Yeah. Different register, different tone. Yeah. I love it. I think my thing was that it was really important for me to enjoy what I was doing. People were saying to me things, they were projecting things onto me. Like when I say people, I mean like I guess peers and other poets would project things onto me, and I'm like, huh, I don't feel that. That's so interesting that you think I'm feeling that. Like they're like, oh, you know, you won, you know, Ted Hughes Award or whatever that puts all this stress on you, there's pressure on you to impress people in the network. I'm like, I don't. That's just not my response to this at all. So I mean, I just kind of wanted to make sure I was doing something that was different and that I was enjoying. And there were some points when I had to walk away from the work that I was writing because I wasn't enjoying it, because I was starting to feel the pressure. But then, you know, with everything else that was happening, particularly in the early days of when lockdown happened in the first one, writing was the only thing keeping me grounded. Because on top of being on lockdown, I was living in London. I wasn't allowed to see my wife, who is in the US. I wasn't allowed to leave. Our visas were halted. We didn't see each other for 8.5 months.
Gosh.
And it was a thing where in order to feel like anything was happening, anything was moving, I was writing, but that only worked for a couple months, and then I hit this wall because I couldn't deal with the uncertainty anymore, because the writing is about, for me anyway, is often about you know, experimenting and in some ways doing something that has no certainty to it. I don't know if what I'm writing is going to create, is going to be, you know, good, or it's going to be published, or it's going to be whatever. So I had to kind of find a way to get back into the space where I was writing privately, and it was just for me. And if it was just for me, it was fun.
Yeah. 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 That's so wonderful. Yeah. I mean, I got through the lockdown somewhat the same way. I started writing for myself, so it was fun.
Yeah.
But also with that fun came storms, huge. I mean, so it freed up all sorts of emotions to live with each other that don't usually allow themselves to be hand in hand. So that's, Have you always understood the importance of fun? I mean, because being in a university, sometimes it sounds like I'm being silly to tell, you know, to urge, you know, encourage people to have fun. To have fun.
To
have fun with writing.
Importance of fun. I guess like. It's strange, isn't it? Because it's got to be a balance. Because if it's just you for your own fun, then you risk self-indulgence.
Yeah.
Just amusing yourself. And if you're put in work out, you want it to be relevant to others, and you want it to other people to find their way into it, right? I'm not thinking about that. It's not until I start thinking, am I going to submit this poem? Is this poem going to be in a book? Is that, you know, so I think you can see it as well. So the next book is called All the Names Given, and it's grounded by an epigraph from a poet, a prose writer, and a sound artist. And my favorite romantic poet of all of them is actually Coleridge, because Coleridge, of all the romantics, in my opinion, is the least English. Like, by that I mean he's the most fun, he's the most musical, he's less sure of himself. If you read Coleridge, it's just like, he's all over the place. He doesn't know where he is. Whereas comparing that to Wordsworth, which is very stiff and serious, and I am the universal voice. And then comparing that to Byron, rather similar thing. Byron can also be playful, but I still sense how seriously he's taking himself. You know, Keats.
Yes.
Beautiful, very melodramatic, but still he's like, but you're serious. But he can do the silly verse too. So Keats for me second. But Coleridge is my favorite poet. So some of the spirit of Coleridge is in this next book.
Wonderful.
And so he's got a line from one of his poems which begins the book, and he says, "Oh, pure of heart, thou needst not ask of me what this strong music in the soul may be." I love that. Absolutely love it.
I love Coleridge, especially too. I carry the poems that I memorized. I was made to memorize as a child. I carry them with me. Now, there is a very. Can you see the chat? You know, if you if you click on the purple X, there's a chat. I can read it, but I'm going to read it out loud. But if you can see it as well, that's good. It turned into an essay. She says, "Never mind, Carlotta. Yeah. There was a part in the end." That I thought was universally relatable, that idea that you're the most triggered person in an empty house. That was an amazing line of many. But I relate to that, and so do a lot of people. It's like feeling you're alone in feeling something. It's a shared feeling among many people. So it's like feeling that you're alone in feeling something that is a shared feeling among many people. All of the poems were emotionally powerful and very relatable. Are you ever worried about revealing too much about yourself, or worried someone you know might read it and see themselves in maybe not the best light? I guess my question is, how do you keep honest but keep the shame at bay? Ooh.
Oh, wow. So first to that, thank you for that thoughtful question, Carlotta. I mean, there's quite a few things to answer in that. So I think the first thing being that, this book and that poem, and there's quite a few poems in this book that I only realized once I'd handed it in that so much of it is about this. It could, like, it, even though there's only one or two poems that explicitly mention a quarantine, even writing that poem, even landing on that line, most triggered person in an empty house, I didn't I wasn't thinking that I was literally in an empty house while I was writing it. That was, again, I was just kind of following thought. And I'm glad that that spoke to you, and I'm glad that gives me that's important for me to know. So yeah, I'm glad. Thank you for sharing resonated with that. The other part of this question about the revealing too much about yourself, I guess yes, and I have been criticized for it. Like, I have read stuff online about how, yeah, you can, you know, if you read this poet, make sure you don't listen to any of his interviews. He gives too much away in his interviews as well. And
hey there, you got frozen.
Yeah, around them, stuff like that. Which I do not adhere to, which links to why I think why I love Coleridge again, about Coleridge not being this kind of stiff, reserved, universal, all-knowing person. Because the thing that's interesting about Coleridge as well is that part of his process was talking to his friends. He brings his friends into his work, and then he will always write that. Like, even when you read his letters, he's talking about how, oh, this line wouldn't have existed without this conversation with this friend, and these are the people who helped me come up. You know, it's just so community orientated and community minded, and isn't trying to bathe in glory. And so I think being open with people and with readers about the work is something that is a good practice for me, because I think I'm writing to connect with people. I want to connect with people. I think that's one of the things that's kept me writing. And people seeing themselves in my work. Yes, I've had some very awkward conversations with my mother. I've got a poem, but all of those conversations I've had with her, I've never published anything that there was one thing where I published a poem, and in it there was one kind of judgment I'd made, and she remembers the situation a bit differently, and we spoke through it. And at first she was really hurt, and I promised that I'd never publish anything that hurt her again, because that protecting her was very important to me. And then I tried to have the poem removed, and then couldn't remove it. It was a mess. But then about a month later, my mum had come back to me, and she said, okay, you know what? It's fine. It's fine to keep the poem. So I've learned from that. I didn't like that feeling of hurting anyone I love. So fortunately, this book, my mom has read it. My sisters.
There. You're coming back.
How do you keep wanting to keep the shame at bay? Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. I haven't back. Gone out, have I? Hello?
You're back now.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry. How do you keep honest but keep the shame at bay? So one of the things that I like to read about and think about a lot is psychology. I've had years of kind of psychiatric therapy and stuff, so thinking about emotion, and also my MA is in teaching, and mainly though in emotional literacy. So emotion, like, so, you know, thinking about shame and language is like a big part of me, and something that I'm always trying to check on. And I think it's Brené Brown. You will probably know Brené Brown. I listen to her podcast, listen to her recommendations and stuff. And she has this thing about how shame is the difference. Like, shame is when you're saying that you are something. Like, if you say you are stupid, or you are dumb, you are, rather than this situation is stupid, or this moment, this thing, if you're channeling it towards yourself, and it's a dangerous thing. And I feel like I'm at a point where poetry, and I was saying to my friend the other day, like, poems are moments. To be honest, nothing I put in a poem, in one poem, is an absolute truth. It's a truth in a moment. which is to say for me, I am that even in the Perseverance, a poem, like, you know, when you read them, I was, you know, in my 20s when I wrote Perseverance. And so there's stuff in there that I'm like, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have said it that way today. I think I remember this a bit differently now. But it's true in that moment. So having no kind of strong allegiance to a truth, this is the truth. To hold things a little bit lighter. Thank you. And it's not easy. It's not easy, but being in therapy has helped. Is a very helpful thing for writers, I think, because we're all in our head so much, and we need to channel some of that head energy away, you know. And yeah.
I want to pick up. It's so interesting what you're saying about in so many different ways about conversation, because one has a conversation with a therapist as well, and that, yes, and you're talking about Coleridge, his right. Yeah, it has the beauty, the ephemeral beauty of the moment in a conversation, and you are talking about how, you know, the conversations you have with your friends, be they be they poets or something else. It's part of life. Now, there's two questions, very different questions that come out of that for me. Mm. Is one is about, you know, you're an activist poet. I mean, you have lots of conversations with students, with young poets, with marginalized poets, and I'm imagining that those conversations are very enjoyable, you know, as well as being important. So I wanted to ask you about that sort of activism, but I also, as a mother, I wanted to ask you if these conversations that you've had with your mother from that first difficult one on, whether it's ever opened up space to talk about very painful things. This is what I find from my own daughter when she writes about very painful things, and then she opens up the space and we can talk about them, we can laugh about them, we can accept that we have different perspectives. And at the end of the day, I let her keep in the line about my Weinstein teeth.
Mm.
So, yeah, anyway, two very different questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to pick up on the question about, the last question you had there. That's... it's a hell of a thing. Yes, it has opened up, like my mom reading stuff I've written about my childhood and some memories. Oh man, I mean, like when I finished The Perseverance and she read it, the first thing she said to me was, you know, I raised you as well. And I had to be like, Mom, he died. I'm processing grief. I'm like, what the hell? Come on. But it was an important point to make. It was an important point because she was just like, oh, you know, I'm tired of women, like, not getting a man would do half as much as a woman would do to raise a child, and he'll get all this applause, and meanwhile the mothers are just, So that's such a real thing. There was a really good interview with one of my favorite sound artists, visual artists, a deaf artist called Christine Sun Kim, and she said how her husband and her child were at the Great Wall of China, and they were walking up along it, and halfway through walking up the wall, she was carrying the baby, and then when she gave the baby to her husband, she said everyone that walked past was like, oh, just such a good dad, you're such a good dad. Meanwhile, when the mother, when Christine had the baby, no one said anything. Like, you know, I think that writing this book and having these conversations with my mother, and even my sister in some ways, has just brought me to, through my own kind of learning. And unlearning, you know, I think that as we get older, we unlearn a lot of these unfortunate ideas. And I think writing has been a practice of staying open to those conversations. It is tricky, and it's a constant kind of navigation. I'm hoping at some point to write fiction so I don't have to deal with this every book, like, you know.
You can have a longer wait between Trouble with Family. Yes.
Oh yeah. Oh,
okay. It's okay. Yeah. I'll save those stories for another time.
Yeah. No. The other part of your question was about like activism. Do I enjoy the conversations I have around activism work? Something that's been kicking around my head a bit recently, and I'm trying to push it out. Someone said something to me a while ago that I thought was really, I don't know where this came from, but he said to me, like, you can't, like, real artists aren't activists kind of thing. It's like, oh, you know, this writer or this paint, this, you know, they're not artists, they're activists. And that kind of binary was so wild to me.
Yeah.
That you're either one or the other, or you can't be a serious writer and a serious activist. And this, oh man. And then I remembered, I was like, wait a minute, this is what they even said about Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison once had that said about her, like, she's just an activist. She's not really a serious writer. And so I'm noticing that it's always marginalized people that are being told. The writers, the women, the anyone, and it's a way to kind of belittle them and undermine their kind of, I don't know, creative contribution.
Because
I think it comes from people actually knowing the power of activism and creativity. It's a powerful thing, like, you know. And I think the poem that I said about the, you know, the erasing of the Ted Hughes and the conversation that I've just been doing that, like. That's a powerful thing. I think it transcends language, and you have this model for, look, this is how society is in your eyes, but if you turn it this way, and then you don't forget that, you know. Yeah. And
it's not in all cultures that there's this distinction. This is a very it's a very Anglophone, you know, cultural attitude. Yeah. So lots of other, you know, nobody would say that about South African writers. No one would say that of writers of the subcontinent there. No one would say that about Turkish writers. The whole job of the writer is to open up that space that's denied otherwise. And so activism always involves being with a lot of working or conversing with a lot of other people. Yeah. So it's sense. Mm-hmm. So one of the most interesting things that you find now, you're working in two countries. So what are the interesting networks that you're part of here? And what are you're obviously discovering your own networks in Oklahoma City as well.
Yeah. I mean, because it's still a pandemic, I haven't been able to meet as many people as I would have liked to. I mean, I think I'd have a different experience then. But like, because Tabitha is working locally, I've got to meet some of her network. And because, you know, working in an art gallery, so it's like instant access to local artists, local thinkers. Mm-hmm. So I haven't really explored that yet. There are just people on the periphery. I guess the interesting thing that's happened is The Perseverance and this next book, All the Names Given, I've just been confirmed to get US releases.
Good.
And like the children's book, Can Bear Skis, also just, you know, come out here in the US, and at the moment it's getting really good reviews. So I think it's the beginning of something. I don't really know
it's good.
What yet.
Yeah. It's always good not to know. We have another question in the, or a comment in the chat that I thought you might like. I would have thought, this is Sherilyn, I would have thought it would be the other way around, that if you're not an activist or if you don't have something to say, you're not an artist.
That's what I thought too. Great point. So well put. So well put. But
so yeah. So I think when people tell me what I'm not, they're really just trying to shut me up. But as you can see, yeah. Chantal, that is a doomed exercise, isn't it, Chantal? But we're coming to towards the end of our hour, and if anybody else has any question or comment to make, you can put it into the chat. If you put it into the chat right now, or otherwise, I was wondering if you could, in a minute, see us off with another poem. Would you mind doing
sure,
that?
Sure. Okay.
I love all the poems, and I just want to tell you that the new ones are just. I just want to hear them again. So we could all do it. Somebody has put a link. One of our friends has put a link to that painting in the chat as well. So we have that.
Oh wow!
Yeah. And before do you have a poem that you think you'd like to?
What to end with?
Yeah.
I think I will end with the last poem in the Perseverance.
Okay.
Which is called Happy Birthday Moon. And I guess it's a poem I wrote because the question I was thinking about was like, you know, where did language begin for me? As a deaf child who loved stories, and so there was this book, you may know it, children's picture book, Happy Birthday Moon, and in the story, it's perfect. I still love it as an adult, but in the story, this bear lives out in the woods, and he goes up to the hill, and it's nighttime, and he looks out over the valleys and the rivers, over the forest, and he looks up at the big full moon that's out, and he says, "It's my birthday." And the bear's voice echoes through the valley, and he hears it again. "It's my birthday." And the bear thinks that the moon is talking to him, and the moon is telling him, "Oh, it's my birthday." So it sets up this kind of deaf poetic with everything that the bear says is being repeated. And yeah, and like, you know, repetition, I think, is a deaf poetic, because we're always having to repeat ourselves. And so my dad would like kind of put me on his chest. He had a very deep voice, and the book was fairly large, so it could be out in front of me. It was like the most kind of inclusive, accidentally deaf aware experience that I had with my dad. So this poem is called Happy Birthday Moon. Dad reads aloud. I follow his finger across the page. Sometimes his finger moves past words tracing white space. He makes the moon say something new every night to his deaf son who slurs his speech. Sometimes his finger moves past words tracing white space. Tonight he gives the moon my name, but I can't say it. His deaf son who slurs his speech. Dad taps the page, says, "I can't say it. I say Rainan Aquabot." He laughs. Dad taps the page, says, "Try again." But I like making him laugh. I say my mistake again. I say Rainan Aquabot. He laughs, says, "Raymond, there's something else." I like making him laugh. I say my mistake again. Rainan Aquabot. "What else will help us?" He says, "Raymond, there's something else. I'd like to be the moon, the bear, even the rain. Rainan Aquabok, what else will help us hear each other, really hear each other? I'd like to be the moon, the bear, even the rain. Dad makes the moon say something new every night, and we hear each other, really hear each other. As Dad reads aloud, I follow his finger across the page."
Ah, Oh, that's wonderful. There's another comment from Laura who says, I've also loved all the poems. They hit me right in the feels. Yes. So.
Wow.
So,
thank you, Laura.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
One of these, and here we are. This is an impossible gathering that we've made possible, and that you brought us all together. Another friend, Kathy, says it's such a beautiful poem. Reminds me of how I bonded with my son in reading to him. Yeah. So, so anyway, thank you for bringing us all together and hitting us in the feels. And read this, his books and buy his book. I hope you can come back to Warwick in the flesh one day, and we'll all be there and we can do a reading when that's possible. I just wanted to tell everybody who's here, remind everybody that we have a master class tomorrow at 4 p.m. our time, crack of dawn your time, tomorrow, and it's on witnessing. And some of you have already RSVP'd. If you haven't or haven't, just write to me again, and I'll be there. And this time it's going to be on Teams, not Black. Okay, so that will be a bit easier. But in the meantime, can we all just thank Ray so much for giving us such a wonderful hour? Yeah, I'm Ray. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for rising to the occasion. Okay, goodbye everybody. And then Ray, we can talk. Stay on for a moment, and I can talk to you about the next thing. Yeah.
Okay.
So, which is on Teams. So I'm going to call you on Teams. Yes. At in like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay. Like at three. But thank you. That was so wonderful. Thank you. So go have some breakfast if you can.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, that was just so wonderful. Anyway, thank you. I'm gonna shut this
Thank
down
you.
Now if I can figure out how that happens. But you can leave and I'll figure it out somehow or other. Yes?
Oh, okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.